Before I begin, I've never begun a sermon this way, but here it goes. Peanut butter. Peanut butter, a benign matter. Unless you're serving your scotcheroos to somebody with a peanut allergy. Shellfish. You can put your shrimp on the table unless someone around the table has a shellfish allergy. Then it can become deadly. We're working our way through 1 Corinthians, and we're at chapter 9 this morning. Last week in chapter 8, Paul introduced us to a matter that had really become a big problem in the city of Corinth and particularly in the church, and that was a matter of meat that had been dedicated to idols, to false gods. And this was not just about your religion. This was a big part of the culture, of the civil nature of the place. And Christians were being confronted with this meat at various places, weddings, other events, just in the marketplace buying meat. And Christians were having a disagreement over whether it was okay for them to partake of this meat that had been offered to a false god, to an idol. And there were those that said, well, we know that there's nothing supernatural that's taken place in that meat. It's meat. There's only one true God. All these idols are false gods. We don't have to worry about it. But there were others that were really feeling in their conscience that if they partook of the meat, that they would be disobeying God, that they would be betraying Christ, that they would be participating in idol worship. And so Paul takes this matter up, and his answer is, conscience before God is a sacred thing. And if you, as someone who knows the truth, that there really is nothing wrong with that meat, and you can eat it, and it'll nourish your body, and that's it, that's fine. Unless by your partaking of that meal, you are causing somebody with a weaker conscience to be tempted to violate their conscience and to eat that meat even though they believe it's wrong. And really the principle that he articulates is that we need to be true to our consciences before God. Conscience is a God-given part of who we are, and it's meant to be protection for us in going astray from him. It's not absolutely infallible. We can educate our consciences. We can train our consciences better to align up with the truth that is revealed in the scriptures. But he exhorts the stronger brothers and sisters to defer their rights, to deny themselves of what they could do freely for the sake of the weaker brother and sister. And Paul gives a strong warning about that, that if we are the cause of somebody stumbling in their conscience, that we are really sinning not only against them, but we are sinning against Christ. We need to remember what Christ was willing to do in terms of self-denial and self-sacrifice for us. And so that's really what chapter 8 talked about, just by way of quick review. This is a theme that obviously was causing a great deal of discord in the Corinthian church, and that is serious enough that Paul is going to devote not only chapter 8, but chapter 9 and chapter 10 to it. In the book of Romans, he wrote chapter 14 to address the same problem in the city of Rome. So this is really a big deal. We don't particularly relate to it here, but it's really a big deal. So as we enter chapter 9 today, he continues what he began last week, but he broadens the application of the principle of self-denial, self-sacrifice for the sake of Christ's mission, for the sake of what Christ wants to do in the lives of people. And he broadens that application to pretty much cover all of life. Let's go ahead and read chapter 9. It's 27 verses. So if you have your Bibles, you can open to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And Paul is going to be using his own life as an example of doing what he is calling the Corinthians to do for one another. So he begins Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not the work, my work in the Lord? If to others I may not be an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. My defense to those who examine me is this: do we not have a right to eat and drink? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Or who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? I'm not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does not the law of God also say these things? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while it is threshing. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope, and the thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things so that we will cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar and have their share from the altar? So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. But I have used none of these things, and I'm not writing these things so that it will be done so in my case. It would be better for me to die than have anyone make my boast an empty one. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I am under compulsion. For woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. But if against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. What then is my reward, that when I preach the gospel, I may offer the gospel without charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel? For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, so that I may win the more. To the Jews I became as a Jew, so that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that I may by all means save some. I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I may become a fellow partaker of it. Do you not know that those who run a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. So to help us grasp what Paul is saying here, let me just quickly overview the flow of this chapter. In verses 1 and 2, Paul is arguing, I'm an apostle. He lists his credentials as an apostle. And that was really an exalted position of authority. And that position entitled him to certain prerogatives and to certain rights. So verses 1 to 2, he says, let me remind you, Corinthian Christians, that I am an apostle. And then in verses 3 through 15, he says, as such, because I'm an apostle, I should be entitled to, and he lists a number of prerogatives that are fully his right as an apostle to claim and to live out. But, he says, I have denied myself these rights. I have sacrificed these rights. I have deferred these prerogatives and rights. And then in verse 16 to the end of the chapter, he basically lets them know why he did this. What has motivated and empowered Paul to lay aside those prerogatives and those rights? And basically it boils down to this. I have denied myself, I have sacrificed my prerogatives and rights, I have deferred for the sake of others out of an obsession and a compulsion toward the gospel, toward the good news. The gospel has just compelled me to live this way, and I'm urging, I'm exhorting, I'm admonishing you to follow my example in this. And so we'll just look at this through two broad lenses. Number one is what Paul does, which is self-denial. And then the second lens will be why he does it, and that is for the sake of the good news. So what Paul does, self-denial. Paul basically testifies here that my life is not governed by my own selfish impulses and cravings. I'm not led by my self-oriented desires, but by a higher order of values and desires. And this doesn't come easily, but it comes by vigorous discipline and training. In more detail, he says, I forgo my apostolic right to eat and drink. To eat and drink. Now, he probably means a couple of things when he says, I've given that right up. Barnabas and I have given that right up. And he probably means at least two things by that. Number one, I have the right to eat and drink anything out there. I mean, you know, I know that, for example, meat that has been offered to idols is perfectly fine. We can eat it, give thanks to God. But I have given up that right so that I won't be a stumbling block to weaker brethren. Even in that day, there was a question about whether it was okay to drink wine, whether it was okay for a Christian to partake of alcoholic beverages. And Paul says, now I know that it would be okay for me to have a glass of wine with my, what would he have a glass of wine? My fish in that day, but for the sake of not being a stumbling block to others, I've given up that right. When I was ordained into this denomination, at that time the denomination was asking all clergy to voluntarily give up partaking of alcoholic beverages. They weren't saying it's absolutely wrong to drink alcohol, to have a beer after moving somebody in on a hot Friday. But they were saying, but there are many people in our society, alcoholics, children of alcoholics, vulnerable people, people who've had their lives destroyed by alcohol, and we want you to be able to minister to everybody. So will you pledge to give up partaking of alcoholic beverages? And Dick, I'm sure you had to do that commitment. I had to do that commitment. And that's what Paul is saying, is that I've chosen to give up my right to eat and drink. But it also probably means I have a right as an apostle to have my sustenance provided by the churches I serve. I have a right to eat and drink at the church's expense, because that's where I'm laboring, that's where I'm working, and I've given up that right. And of course, he'll come back to that point again. He says, also, I've given up the right to take along a wife. Now, if you remember, those of you who were here in chapter 7, Paul talked about marriage and singleness, and he said, I advocate for the single life. If you can do it, if God has given you that ability, if he's given you the gift, we call it the gift of celibacy, so that you can be contented as a single person, Paul says, I advocate that life. It frees you up to devote yourself to serving the Lord. And Paul, while he may at one time have had a wife, there are indications that he may have had a wife. He did not at this point in time, whether his wife had died or whether she had left him when he became a follower of Jesus, we don't know. But he chose to remain single and just devote himself to the work that Christ had called him to do. And so Paul says, I could have a right. I could have a wife. I have a right to a wife. But I've given up that right for the sake of the ministry of the gospel. And further, he would be entitled as an apostle to bring his wife along with him. Apparently Cephas or Peter did that. And to have provision for himself and his wife and family from the churches, for their ministry in the churches. And so he's saying, I've given up all of that for the sake of my work in the gospel. And then the bulk of this section, he says, I have given up my right to you, Corinthians, to be supported by you. I've come and I've labored there. I've been your pastor for a year and a half, and I didn't take any contributions from you at all. Now, this was something that Paul would do from place to place. He was a tent maker. He could devote time to producing tents and selling them and provide for his needs and his team's needs. We know that in Ephesus, he basically didn't take any support from the church. We know in Thessalonica, he basically didn't take any support from the church. Other places, he apparently did. He was willing to receive financial compensation. But Paul repeatedly emphasizes in various ways in this section, that is what God has ordained. God has ordained in the Old Testament that the Levites and priests would have their living provided for by the people they were serving. And that has continued into the New Testament, where those that God has called as pastors and elders, his intention, his normal intention, is for them to be supported by the churches that they're serving. But Paul says, but I have voluntarily given up that right, and I've not received any remuneration from you, Corinthians. I wanted the privilege of being able to minister the gospel freely. God has called me. Christ has called me to this. I have a charge. I'm under obligation. It's my duty before Christ to do this. The only reward that I can give myself is for what I do voluntarily, beyond what Christ has called me to do. And Christ didn't call me to do this without receiving compensation, but I'm choosing to do that. And so he's holding forth himself as an example here of deferring his rights, of denying his rights, of sacrificing for the sake of other people, for the sake of his ministry of the gospel. He has voluntarily given up his rights. He has sacrificed his personal freedom. He says, I have made myself a slave to all people. I have adapted myself to become all things to all people. When I was reaching out to Jewish people, I adopted Jewish customs and probably wore his, I don't know if they wore a yarmulke back then or not, but he adapted himself and he followed the Jewish customs in order not to offend them and to have an open channel of relationship with them, in order to have a bridge for being able to share the good news of Jesus. When he was with those who were without the law, Gentiles, and they didn't care about the laws of Moses, they didn't care about Jewish dietary habits, they didn't care about Jewish festivals. And Paul would give up those things and he would adopt a Gentile culture in order to reach them. He says, to the weak, I became weak. I just adopted myself to what they needed in order that I might be able to have relationship and not put any stumbling block before them. He rigorously disciplines himself to conduct himself for the sake of the gospel. Now, he's not saying that he compromised. He's not saying that he disobeyed what Christ has clearly called us to do. He didn't disobey the commands of Christ. But in matters of moral indifference, in matters that we're free to do or not do, Paul says, I configured myself and I accommodated myself in order not to be in any way an offense to others, and in order to commend the gospel. One commentator says this, if a person is offended by God's word, that is his problem. If he's offended by biblical doctrine or standards or church discipline, that's his problem. That person is offended by God. But if he is offended by our unnecessary behavior or practices, no matter how good and acceptable those may be in themselves, his problem becomes our problem. It is not a problem of law, but a problem of love, and love always demands more than the law. Now, what does it mean for us? What does Paul's example mean for us? It means avoiding unnecessary impediments and commending the gospel. Living in a way that we avoid unnecessary impediments to the gospel and conducting ourselves in such a way that it commends the gospel. Impediments. Those things which can prevent people from listening to us. Can prevent them from even being willing to allow us to give them a hearing. I do not put bumper stickers on my car. I certainly do not put political bumper stickers endorsing candidates or even sports teams. I mean, there are maniacs out there that you put the wrong sports team on your car and you can risk getting keyed for one thing, but I just want to avoid unnecessary divisions from people. I don't want there to be things that could hinder me from being able to represent Jesus to somebody. Unnecessary impediments. It's fully my right to declare the candidates or the political parties that I support. But I want to submit those things to the greater value of the good news of Jesus. So this is a call to avoid unnecessary impediments in our lives. I think one of the big impediments, especially here in American culture, is we just have the ability to live in our comfort zones, to live for ourselves, to pursue our temporal desires in this world. You know, our lives can basically boil down to going to work to earn a paycheck, coming home, remotely opening the garage door, remotely closing the garage door, and that's all that our neighbors see of us. We can be so wrapped up in the here and now, and we look like we're living just like everybody else. Just like everybody else, we're pursuing the same things they're pursuing. We have the same earthly hopes and dreams they have. And preparing to present this message this morning has really caused me to look afresh and anew at my life. It's so easy to get caught up in that. And living earthbound, self-focused lives is really an impediment to our gospel witness. Paul also wanted to live in a way that commended the good news. Now think about this. We are proclaiming a message of self-sacrificial, undeserved, lavish love to people. That's what the good news of Jesus is, that while we were yet sinners, God sent his Son, Jesus, who came to give his life as a sacrifice, so that we could be forgiven of our sins, we could be made brand new people, given a whole new life that is life indeed and will go on forever without ending. That's the message we proclaim. And we can commend that message by the way we live, or we can undermine that message by the way we live. Do we demonstrate the love of Jesus for his enemies? When we encounter somebody who cuts us off in traffic, when we encounter somebody who does something to offend us in the grocery store, do we respond just like everybody else out there responds? Or do we respond like Jesus did from the cross when he said, "Father, forgive them. These people who have nailed me here, who have wrongly condemned an absolutely innocent man, forgive them." Do we demonstrate in our lives the love that we proclaim in our message? Do we live graciously, extending undeserved favor to people? Or do we do what Jesus said the world does? We greet those who greet us back. We entertain those who can pay us back by welcoming us in return. And Paul says, I have disciplined myself, I've trained myself so that I will be able to embody in the way I live the message that I want people to believe, the Jesus that I'm representing to people. So that's what Paul does. Why does he do this? And he says, I do all things for the sake of the gospel. I do all things for the sake of the good news, so as not to hinder it, but to commend it. He says, I'm compelled by the gospel. I can't do otherwise. I want to do it voluntarily, but even if I don't feel like doing it, I've got this God-given obligation. I am a steward. This is a message that will determine people's destinies. It will determine people's eternity. There is nothing more important that you and I have been entrusted with. Nothing more valuable than this gospel message. So much is hanging in the balance based on this. And Paul says, nothing in comparison, nothing else matters. So I am absolutely compelled by the gospel, by this message, by this good news, by my Jesus. I do it in order to win the more, to trust in Jesus, to win the more, to receive the free gift that he offers. I've done this. I've become all things to all people so that by all means I might save some. I might see some saved. Say that with me. I do all things for all people that by all means I might save some. I do all things for all people that by all means I might save some. Paul says that's the driving force. I keep that in front of me. I keep that in front of me. I wake up in the morning. I set that before me all during the course of the day. That's on my dashboard. I'm looking at life through that lens. I do all things, everything I do, for the sake of all the people that I'm encountering, that God lays in my path, that by all means I might save some. I might save some. And he links this, and this, he doesn't spend a lot of time on this, but we've got to catch this. In verse 27, he says, I discipline, I buffet my body, I make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. And we can just let that slide by and miss that, but that's like a major warning sign in the middle of the road, flashing, sirens blaring. Notice this. I am obsessed. I am compelled. I live for the gospel, lest I, who have preached to so many others this message, could in the end find myself disqualified from it. Now there's a powerful link in that statement that we've got to see. It is a powerful link. And I worked on saying this right, so let me see if I can find it here. I've left my manuscript and now I'm lost. But Paul essentially links our trusting the gospel with our being compelled by it in how we live. And he essentially says, I've got to find that. He essentially declares that if we aren't living out the good news toward others, both in the church and outside the church, he basically says, if we're not living out the good news toward others, we really haven't grasped or believed it ourselves. That's fundamentally what he's saying. If we're not living it outwardly toward others, then we really haven't received it ourselves. And if we think about it, if we just kind of soak in that for a while, it makes abundant sense just because of the nature of what the gospel is. We see the example of Jesus, what he's done toward us. Even when he washed the disciples' feet, and they were blown away by this. Peter was so taken aback that he initially refused. "You're not touching my feet, Jesus." But Jesus said, "The example that I've given you, what you have experienced from me, compels you to go and do the same for others. What you've seen me do, what you've experienced me doing to you, will take over your life. If you receive it from me, it will take over your life, and it will compel you to do the same thing for others. It's my life. It's not only my example. If all Jesus gave us was his example, that would not be good news. We would not call that gospel. But Jesus not only gave us his example, he gave us his very life. Someone who is in Christ has received the life of Christ within them. And that life not only is reflected in what he did, but it begins to transform us to be more and more and more like him. So he's given us his example, he's given us his life, he's given us his spirit. And that's why Paul can say fundamentally here that if we aren't living out the good news toward others, toward one another here and toward those outside, we really haven't grasped or believed the good news ourselves. Proclaiming grace that we really haven't received. Proclaiming that kind of love that we really haven't received. Do you remember this morning? Do you remember who you were before Jesus? Do you remember, sadly, who you still are too much of the time? Do you remember the depth of the ugliness, the brokenness, the sinfulness, the selfishness that you still see if you take an honest look in the mirror? Do you remember the degree of, come on, we had to be that bad in order for God to be willing to do what he did. Our problem had to be that bad. The Father would not have sent his Son and put him through what he went through. The Son would not have come. Jesus pled, "Let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will but yours." Jesus pled to be released from this. If our problem wasn't that serious, that wouldn't have been necessary. Do you remember how bad your problem was and is? Do you remember what Christ did for you, what the Father has done for you, and what he has secured for you? Do you remember where you were, and do you remember where you're going and what is locked up as a secure vault in heaven for you? Was recently reading a summary biography of a British pastor and professor by the name of Charles Simeon. He lived in the late 1700s, early 1800s. But Charles Simeon became a follower of Jesus at about age 18, and he never lost sight of the awe of what Jesus did for him. Never lost sight of who he had been and what it took and what Jesus had accomplished for him. He decided to enter the pastoral ministry, and he was in Church of England, and the presiding bishop assigned him to a church that didn't want him. They had a very well-liked assistant pastor in that church, and so when the senior priest left, they wanted their assistant priest as their pastor, but the bishop wasn't willing to do that. And the people made clear to Charles Simeon, "We don't want you. Go away." And so Pastor Simeon went to the bishop and said, "They don't want me. They want me to go away. So I'm not going to force myself upon them." And the bishop said, "Well, you can do that, but I'm not going to give them the assistant pastor no matter what. I'm going to give them the person of my choosing, and so you might as well stay there." And so Charles Simeon stayed for 5 years. The first 5 years of his pastoral ministry there, they wouldn't let him preach at the evening service. They had the prerogative to decide who their preacher was, and so the Sunday evening service, they said, "We don't want you," and they had the assistant pastor preached for those 5 years. For the first 12 years, back then they had assigned pew boxes, and you had to rent them or purchase them, and they had little doors that were lockable. And for the first 12 years of his pastorate there, the members that owned the pew boxes locked them and did not attend. And they would not allow anybody to sit in those pew boxes. And so the only people that were able to come were those that he could squeeze into the aisles. And he tried to provide some stools or chairs for them. The members threw the stools out. They did everything they could to resist him and oppose him. Now, he ended up being pastor of that church for 54 years. The vast majority of those years, he was assigned to a people who did not want him and who made that abundantly clear. Well, some of his fellow pastors saw what he was going through, saw just the miserable nature of the calling that he had, and they said, "How are you dealing with this? How are you hanging in there? You could have resigned many times over, gotten a much more comfortable place. How do you hang in there?" And Charles Simeon testified that what he had done just on a daily basis was to meditate on his own undeservedness, meditate on his own sinfulness, his own wretchedness, almost to the point of despair, but then to think in absolute wonder of what God had done for him, of what Jesus had done for him, and how undeserving it was. And so he was able to fight off that pride that says, "I deserve better." He was able to fight off that sense of entitlement that we so often fall into. I know what that's about. You know what that's about. But because he every day was really in touch with his utter undeservedness of anything good from God and overwhelmed by the amazing grace that he had received, he was able joyfully to endure those afflictions and troubles and the animosity directed toward him. He remembered who he was. He remembered and understood what Christ had done for him, and he was able to deny himself. He was able to sacrifice. He was able to defer his own personal comforts for the sake of love, of Jesus, of people, of the good news. Paul refers at the end here, he refers to an athletic illustration and to a runner training and to a boxer training and a runner competing and racing and a boxer competing. Now, in Corinth, every 2 years, they would hold what were called the Isthmian Games. It was like the Olympics, but they would hold the Isthmian Games, and the best athletes would come to compete in the Isthmian Games. And these were rigorous. There were qualification requirements. The athletes had to demonstrate that they had been training pretty much full-time for the 10 months prior to the games. They had to provide proof that they had been fulfilling the training requirements, 10 months of training requirements. They had to demonstrate that they were able to meet certain standards. And then for 30 days before the games, each contestant was required to participate in a daily workout in the gymnasium under supervision. Whatever organizers and administrators there were absolutely determined, we're not going to get people in here who can't compete and who don't deserve it. And so then they would come and they would compete, and there would be one winner in the foot race, one winner in the boxing match, and the winners would receive this pine bough wreath crown made of pine boughs. They would be given great honor. Poems would be written about them. When they returned to whatever city they were from, it was customary to break a hole in the city wall so that they could enter through the wall. And it basically was signifying a city that has a hero like this doesn't need city walls for protection. We've got a superstar here. And that was kind of the, and they were given front row seats if they came to any games in the future to attend. And Paul says, I have what we see those athletes doing for this perishable wreath. How long do you think we can answer this because we do the same thing at Christmas, right? We take pine boughs and we turn them into decorations. How long do they last? Not long. And Paul says, these athletes devote themselves to that kind of rigorous training for the sake of a perishable pine wreath. You and I are dealing with matters that will translate into an eternal crown, a crown that's forever, that lasts forever. And so he says, I live very intentionally. He says, I don't want to be running aimlessly, going through the motions, but the finish line's over there, and I'm just kind of lollygagging around here. I'm getting my steps in. How am I doing? All right, I got 3 out of 5 dots. Doing good. About 6,000 steps out of my 10,000 that I need. But Paul says, I'm headed toward the finish line. I've got the goal firmly in mind, and I keep my eyes pointed on the goal. I don't just go through the motions. I don't want to run aimlessly. And he says, and I don't just beat the air. I don't just go through the motions. When I throw a punch, I want it to land home. And he says, and so I train myself. And literally in the Greek, it says, I punch myself in the face. You can imagine a boxer training for the Isthmian Games, and they're going to have sparring partners, and they want to be hit because they got to be able to take punches from a real opponent, and so they want to take some smacks in the face or body blows because they've got to be able to take a punch in the ring. And Paul says, and I'm my own sparring partner. If I don't have somebody doing that for me, I do it to myself. And of course, he's speaking figuratively, but he just wants the Corinthians to know how rigorously I discipline myself and how intentional and definitive and purposeful I am in this. And he's, again, commending his example to them. What's the exhortation to us? Oh, people, what you have received from Christ, truly let it take over your lives. Don't just try and take a spoonful now and then, but be so awed and overwhelmed and amazed every day, every part of your lives, but what Jesus has done, is doing for you, that you let it take over, that you just digest it, let it fill you and let it overflow you so that Jesus, it's not you, it's Jesus through you, is spilling over to others. People of God, discipline, conduct yourselves for the eternal good news, for the mission of Jesus to others. You're not going for a temporary crown, you're going for an eternal crown. And there's not only one that can win, but in the gospel, in the good news race, in the mission that we are on, we can all win if we will devote ourselves to the race that we've been given to run. But it's not going to come easily. Paul says it's going to require sustained and rigorous effort, and it's going to require purposefulness and intentionality. People, discipline is not a word we like to hear. Self-discipline, self-denial is not a word that we like to hear. But there's no other way for us to run this race. Paul says there's no shortcut. There's no easy way through it. We've got to begin. And as in any athletic effort or other worthy effort, discipline is progressive. Discipline is progressive. You don't just start being able to bench 300 pounds. You got to start with 20 and then 50 and move on up, and then you can do 100. And in the Christian life, discipline is progressive. And we will not begin to attain the kind of discipline that Paul urges us on if we don't have the foundational self-disciplines in place. We hear it again and again and again, but if we're not meditating day and night in the Word, the rest of the disciplines are going to be unattainable to us. if we won't embrace the self-discipline and the self-denial that will get us with God in His Word on a daily basis, that's foundational, that's fundamental. The other disciplines will spring from that. Prayer on a daily basis, going to God, sitting at His feet, opening up our hearts and our lives to Him, telling Him what we're thinking, what we're feeling, what we're wanting, what we're needing, listening through His Word, listening for His Spirit. These are the fundamental disciplines. The other disciplines that are needed to live this way will flow from them. So I appeal to us, I exhort us again, it's worth it. So much, you know, we can look at it this way. We do discipline ourselves. There are goals that are directing our steps, that are guiding the course of our lives, whether that's building our bank accounts or getting temporal security in this world. We are disciplining ourselves. The question is, toward what end? What we're pursuing will determine how we discipline ourselves. And Paul appeals to us to really consider what is worth sacrificing our lives for, what is worth disciplining ourselves for, and to devote ourselves there. By way of conclusion, I'll just quote John MacArthur. He says this: Paul put his body into subjection, into slavery to his mission of winning souls for Christ. Most people, including many Christians, are instead slaves to their bodies. Their bodies tell their minds what to do. Their bodies decide when to eat, what to eat, how much to eat, when to sleep, when to get up, and so on. An athlete cannot allow that. He follows the training rules, not his body. He runs when he would rather be resting. He eats a balanced meal when he would rather have a chocolate sundae. He goes to bed when he would rather stay up. And he gets up early to train when he would rather stay in bed. An athlete leads his body. He does not follow it. It is his slave, not the other way around. Many believers are unwilling to pay the price. The flesh, the world, everyday affairs, personal interests, and often simple laziness hinder spiritual growth and preparation for service. Even good things can interfere with the best. Fulfillment of freedoms can interfere with fulfillment of love. Following our own ways can keep others from knowing the way. Souls are won by those who are prepared to be used when the Spirit chooses to use them. I know it might be tempting to feel beat up. That's not what Paul was going for. That's not what the Holy Spirit is going for. That's not what I'm going for. We want to be able to face ourselves as we are, but then we want the longing of Jesus, the longing of the Spirit of Jesus, just to flood us so that we will give up chasing these trinkets and trifles and instead desire what is truly worthy.